You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in Fermosel.
Welcome, Richard. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Fran. Yes, my name's Richard Moore. That's Fran Reyes. Well, it's a welcome back to both of us because you took a little holiday over the weekend.
Yeah, I went to the wedding of a former classmate. It was an enlightening experience because it made me realize how old I am now and the fact that in 10 or 15 years at most, I will be married and will have children. And yeah, that is, at this point of my life, it is a bit depressing to think that.
Yeah, let's not talk about age, Fran. Lionel Burney has left the Vuelta. I think he left with Dan Martin. They both left the Vuelta. Dan Martin didn't start today. Lionel Burney didn't start today. Both they're returning for similar reasons, actually. I hope Lionel doesn't mind me saying that. But Dan Martin's wife is pregnant with twins, they are due very soon, so he's left the Vuelta to be present for that and to, well, I don't know how this will affect whether or not he rides the World Championships in Innsbruck, because that's a course that will really suit him, and I'm not actually sure what his intentions are for that, but I guess we'll find out. Anyway, will I crack on with the tail of the etapa, try to get straight back in the saddle?
Yeah,
of
definitely,
this Vuelta?
Because it's going to be short, right? The tail of the etapa today?
Well, yeah, pretty short, yeah. I mean, it was a fairly uneventful stage, Salamanca to Fermoselle, and we're in this tiny village of Bermillo de Sayago.
Yeah, 500 people.
500 people live here, yeah. So that's something you notice about the Vuelta. It does take you places like this, which you would never go to on the Tour de France, for example. Yeah. And so it's just a different scale to it altogether. Salamanca, on the other hand, was very grand and beautiful setting for the start of the stage today, and it was really quite stunning.
Yeah, it's one of the main cities in Spain, I would say, especially because of its university. It's huge and very old and very, very prestigious. You know, there are even several sayings in Spain that do imply that Salamanca is the hotbed for knowledge in Spain.
Former student there is Malcolm Mollema's wife. And we'll hear about that in part three of tonight's podcast. The stage got underway. It was lovely weather as well, 24 degrees, much more pleasant than it's been, I know, in the first week. Jesús Ezquerra from the Burgos BH team was the early attacker. He got away on his own, which I'm sure it wasn't the intention. There was a counter-attack behind him, quite a few good names in there. Thomas De Gendt, Thiago Machado. But it was closed. And Marco Irizar was there as well. That was brought back. Movistar closed it down. Thiago Machado, a Portuguese rider, they were racing close to the Portuguese border today. He persisted and got away, well, initially with Richie Porte, strangely enough. Richie Porte sat up, but Machado carried on, and he caught up with Ezquerra, and they formed the attacking duo. They formed the attacking duo. Behind, Bora and Trek were kind of keeping it a manageable distance. There wasn't a lot today apart from the climb just before the finish, the Alto de Fermosella climb.
Yes.
And it was, the break didn't quite survive till then. Ezquerra cracked before then, leaving Machado on his own. But not for long, because he was swept up as they approached the climb. Alejandro Valverde, Peter Seri, Nairo Quintana were first over the top of that. Then Diego Rubio, also from Burgos BH, attacked, and he was off on his own for a bit. And he was helped, actually, by a spate of punctures behind. There were lots and lots of punctures. They affected, in particular, a lot of the favourites. Thibaut Pinot, Nairo Quintana. There was real panic around that. He seemed to take a while to get back on. Four teammates dropped back to help him. Simon Yates, the red jersey, punctured. Wilco Kelderman punctured and then broke a wheel. Meanwhile, Rubio was still out front. And Albacini, Igor Anton, Theo Gegenhardt, they all punctured as well. It was amazing. And we might have an answer for why there were so many punctures, which Fran's going to give us in a moment or two. But in the on the approach to the finish, Lucas Postelberger clipped off the front. We saw him do that stage one of the Giro d'Italia last year. When he won the stage, there was an opportunity. He took it, got the stage, didn't work out this time. He was chased back by Michael Morkov, who was the lead-out man for Elia Viviani, after a very, very effective lead-out by Quick-Step. And they claim their second victory of the day because Julian Alaphilippe also won the stage of the Tour of Britain. It was his 60th victory of the season as Viviani won ahead of Peter Sagan and Giacomo Nizzolo from Trek Segafredo. Overall, Simon Yates kept the red jersey by 1 second from Valverde with Nairo Quintana third. Luis Angulmati is in the King of the Mountains jersey. Peter Sagan is in green and Valverde is in the combined jersey. So as I said, 60th win of the season for Quickstep, and Viviani thinks there's another 3 stages that he could possibly win.
Although nobody suffered as a result of all those punctures in the final 15 kilometres, there was a really nasty crash with 41 kilometres to go, a touch of wheels we think, and Simone Petilli, the UAE Team Emirates rider, went down very heavily and looked in very bad condition. He was stationary for a while. People were quite worried about him. It was quite alarming and quite sickening to watch. He was loaded into an ambulance and the team released a statement after the stage which said that he had suffered concussion and had briefly been unconscious. He has also suffered a deep cut at the left eyebrow arch which requires stitches, and some of his teeth are broken. He's now in Zamora Hospital in good condition, stable and able to interact with the team's doctor. The CAT scan that he's had has excluded neurological problems, so he's out of the race obviously, and in a bad way, but we wish all the best to Simone Petilli.
The community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast and enabling us to be here. I arrived at the Vuelta with 4 prestigious Pedalar de Charme t-shirts made by Rafa in my luggage, and we got rid of one of them today.
Exactly. Unfortunately, you gave it to me. I thought it was a present, but no, it was a present for someone else. I had to deliver it.
Luis Angulmati won the listeners' hearts, not just with his attacking riding, and he's a charming guy. He smiles a lot, but he was very conscientious in disposing of the wrappers from his gels and energy bars. He was seen always putting them back in his pocket, which we shouldn't be applauding that, because that's what everybody should actually do rather than chucking it all to the side of the road. But unfortunately, you do see a lot of bottles and wrappers thrown to the side of the road. So it's unfortunate that Matty is singled out for that, but there we have it.
Yeah, but we have to set an example in order for people to follow. You know, in the case of water bottles, I would say is not that bad, because after all, water bottles, if thrown in an area where there is public, are precious gift for
so a lot
the
of them
fans.
Will be picked up, yeah.
Exactly, but with the wrappers, it's definitely waste, and it is not.
You'd have to be a pretty dedicated fan to collect empty gel wrappers, wouldn't you?
But I'm sure if I wasn't a journalist, I would be collecting them. But well, that's another topic.
Anyway, Fran, you went and presented Luis Angulmati with his Pedalar de Charme t-shirt. He actually was our Pedalar de Charme 2 years ago at the Vuelta, so he got one of the old style t-shirts then. But you also spoke to him in Spanish. We're going to hear that interview now. We're going to dub it ourselves as we hear the interview. So you play the part of Fran Reyes.
Okay.
And I'll play the part of Luis Angulmati.
I don't like my character.
Will that work? I don't know. Well, let's see if you can carry it off, shall we? Let's go.
Aquí estamos con Luis Ángel Maté, orgulloso pedaleador.
We are here with Luis Ángel Maté, awarded with a Pedalar de Charme t-shirt by the Cycling Podcast. Listeners, tell us, what does this award mean for your sporting career?
Well, it's nice to get some recognition for your work. I'm thankful there is a lot of people who support me and pushes me to keep going forward.
Will you wear your Pedalar de Charme t-shirt today over your King of the Mountains jersey?
Not at all, but I'll wear it at home. You gave me one of these t-shirts 2 years ago, and to this day I still wear it pretty often.
Most of our listeners have voted for you because of how committed you are to do an environmental friendly cycling. Why do cyclists have to care about this?
Oh, that means all my breakaways didn't help me to get this t-shirt. Had you told me this last week, I wouldn't have spent 800 kilometres on the front. Joking aside, cycling is and should always be an environment-friendly sport. Sustainable development is based on sustainable mobility, and bicycles are essential for that. We, the pro riders, have to set an example, making cities more human and less polluted. There ought to be fewer cars and more bikes in the streets.
How many wrappers do you have on your pockets at the end of every stage of La Vuelta?
As many as I carry at the beginning of the stage. A wrapper weighs nothing and it costs nothing carrying it in your back pocket. The earth is our home and I wouldn't throw any rubbish in my home's dining room. The earth is our home and we're responsible for looking after it. Well, that was Luis Angelmati, played by me. But fine words there from Luis Angelmati. So a very deserving winner of the first Pedler de Charme of the Vuelta. And we'll do a week two poll later this week. Fran, the stage wasn't perhaps the most exciting stage of the Vuelta, but it did become quite dramatic in the final 15 kilometres when we had all these punctures. It was remarkable. I mean, it was almost as if there were tacks on the road or something. People were suspecting some kind of foul play, but you went at the finish to speak to some teams and riders and people and try and find out what exactly had happened, what caused all these punctures.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to several riders and some of them were actually thinking that there were tacks on the road because of the amount of punctures that we saw. But later I found Emanuele Viti from Movistar, who was chatting with an amateur rider from this Salamanca province. And he told us that apparently there are a lot of thistles close to the road.
I mean, people will be suspecting foul play here because, you know, the buffalo arrived. I'm from Scotland and suddenly there are thistles at the Vuelta a España. What's going on?
Exactly.
Did I bring thistles with my Pedler de Charme t-shirts?
I didn't see any, but I can notice I'm kind of itchy, so maybe it has something to do with you. But no. It was
joking aside. These are thorns that are on the bushes in this area, and there's perhaps some of them. It was after the climb, wasn't it?
Exactly. And apparently, because of the way the wind was blowing, there were some thistle fields, and the fruit of those thistles, who has small thorns, quite pointy, quite sharp, provoked these punctures. At the finish line, actually, most mechanics were not quite sure about anything, you know, and thought the most extended hypothesis was that there was a lot of loose gravel on the roadside. But later on, I learned from a neutral service mechanic that it definitely was abrojos, as we call it in Spanish, thistles, that caused these crashes.
Wilco Kelderman, punctures.
Puncture, crashes.
Wilco Kelderman was one of the puncture victims. He got back on and then broke a wheel in the final kilometer. Obviously didn't lose any time. But, it was sort of ominous because it was similar in a way to Tom Dumoulin lost that time at the Tour de France with a broken wheel. Wilco Kelderman lost time last week with a broken bike. And, you know, he looked very strong the other day on the climb, but again, there was a bit of bad luck for him today, and he wasn't the only one. I mean, a lot of the top riders had problems today, and they're all, you know, the overall hasn't changed at all. It's still the same.
Do you know whose bike Wilco Kelderman finished the stage with?
I do, actually, Fran, yeah. It was Michael Storer, the young Australian rider, baby-faced Michael Storer.
Yeah, another. I mean, looking at his face today at the start, they felt really old.
Well, he used to live. He lived in Glasgow for a bit, so I'm keen to speak to him. I'm bringing a lot of Scotland in tonight's episode of the cycling podcast. But he lived in Glasgow for a bit because his Italian girlfriend lived there, but he doesn't anymore. But yeah, he is quite a bit smaller, I think, than Wilco Kelderman. So. That can't have been a great fit, but he was there. And
yeah, it was
to,
a kilometre. It was a kilometre.
Didn't matter.
So, yeah.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Whether you're grinding up the French Alps or just taking your mates on around a local loop, Science in Sport Rego Rapid Recovery Plus will help you recover faster after your ride, so you're ready to go again the next day.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. You can get 25% off your Science Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. And now, Daniel Freib, Hello there, Freiba. Freiba.
Yeah, that was Daniel. Absolutely Daniel. Butchered yeah, my name there.
Daniel, what happens now then? What do we do now?
I can see you're very rusty.
I'm very rusty,
as far
yeah.
as podcasting is concerned. I saw you outside pacing around outside doing podcasting drills earlier, trying to get back in the swing.
Sweating. Yeah. Just testing. 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, continuously for the whole afternoon.
So what happens now? What have you been doing with napalm at this point? I mean, what, you know, just ease me back in here.
I thought napalm... generally he coped fairly well. We know that he's not in his natural environment when it comes to the Vuelta. He struggles with the heat, he struggles with the policia, the police, but I thought
he struggles with the police.
He has done in the past, hasn't he?
Had a few run-ins,
yeah,
have he?
But beyond that he took most of it in his stride.
And it's very short stride with
it's quite a short stride. I think he was a bit aggrieved at the gastronomic variety on offer. What is that correct to say? I can't remember whether this was on or off the record.
There was a lot of talk of croquetas.
There was some grousing.
It's a bit like London and rats. You know, in Spain, you're never more than about five feet from
exactly
a croqueta.
Right, exactly right.
Not that, I mean, they taste much better than rats, it has to be said. We had some delicious croquetas last night, actually, in our beautiful hotel. It's much cooler. This is... about 25 degrees today. It's been a lot hotter than this, hasn't it? I mean, this was quite pleasant today, really.
Very pleasant, Rich, yeah. You can really feel that we've moved north. We're sort of facing the Bay of Biscay almost now. Well, the trajectory is a northward one. We're heading towards the Atlantic.
Very close to Portugal. Very close to Portugal. Daniel, how did you spend your rest day?
This sounds like a bit of a cross-examination already.
More like a leading question, I think.
Well, Richard, we were up very early in the morning, as we're always up very early in the morning, and went straight to the Mitchelton Scott Hotel. Had a bit of an appointment with Simon Yates. Had a bit of a chat with him about the race so far, about getting the red jersey by accident.
But another little thing on Mitchelton Scott, and we'll hear a little bit later from Jack Haig, who's the only rider who rode both the Giro and the Vuelta alongside Simon Yates. But they, or it's confirmed that Neil Stevens has left the team. Now, a couple of weeks ago when I met Matt White at the San Sebastian Classic, I asked him whether Neil Stevens was going to be doing the Vuelta, because he normally does. You know, he lives near San Sebastian, so I was surprised to not see him there. And Matt White said that Neil Stevens had not worked at all with the World Tour team this year. So he'd been working a little bit with the team, but seemed to have really taken a backseat role. So he talked in a statement that he released today about a change of philosophy. I hear a rumour that he may go to UAE Team Emirates, although there's also talk of him setting up his own team. But quite a surprise, because he was one of the original sort of founding members of the, you know, what was Green Edge when it started.
Well, in fact, Rich, one of my most recent memories of Neil Stevens and... well, realising how influential Neil Stevens was in that team was from 2016 in the same town and after the same finale of a stage that we'll see tomorrow in Luintra. In, I don't know, are we in tomorrow? Are we still in Castilla y León?
I think so.
I think we are. And Simon Yates was the winner. And that was a victory orchestrated by Neil Stevens to a large extent. And he had the real... a lot of the local knowledge that team brought to the Vuelta came from Neil Stevens. Of course, Matt White also lives in Spain, but on the other side of Spain, towards Valencia. Neil Stevens lives in the Basque Country, doesn't he? But, there's something...
And spent most of his career on Spanish teams. Well, Festina, Once, yeah. Then he was a DS at Movistar for many years.
But I dare say we'll find out more about the reasons for his departure in due course. I hesitate to say that it might be controversial, but it might be controversial.
Well, it's unusual for a DS to leave abruptly mid-season, although, as Matt White described it, he'd been phased out this year, it looked like. And I don't know, I'd always thought Matt White and Neil Stevens were very close, but you know, Matt White has been at the Vuelta, he's away at the moment, he's coming back for the final week. And, you know, he certainly has emerged as the more senior figure, I suppose, and the team is very much sort of you know, he is the guy that you now associate most, he's most identifiable with the team as a personality and as a well, certainly a voice that we hear quite a lot on the podcast, isn't he? And we'll speak to him next week and maybe try and get a bit more on that. But how was Simon Yates? I mean, as you said, he sort of took the jersey accidentally, or certainly not on purpose. And Valverde's just a second down. We were talking about how difficult it is to concede a second in a Grand Tour. You know, how ideally it would pass on to Valverde. That would probably suit most people, Valverde and Movistar. But there was a second up for grabs at an intermediate sprint today, and it was George Bennett that got it, surprisingly. So how was Yates' mood? How was he feeling on the rest day about being in this position?
I think the most interesting thing that I picked up was, well, he reaffirmed really that he's under orders to ride quite conservatively, or has been under orders. We've talked quite a lot about that in the podcast. And he told me yesterday he has found it quite frustrating at times. He's really had the handbrake on the two summit finishes we've had so far. He was conscious that that might sound a little bit arrogant when he has, well, he gained time on the first summit finish and then he did pretty well at La Covetilla, but he said, well, I was kind of brought back down to earth when I did sort of accelerate a little bit at La Covetilla, but ultimately lost time. But I think he's pretty confident. He sort of carries in himself and walks around with a lot of self-assurance, a lot of poise these days. Doesn't necessarily always say a lot, doesn't give too much away. You still get the impression that he really lives and breathes bike racing and isn't too interested in, and maybe this is one of his great strengths, isn't too interested in the context and, you know, what it all means, or you know, other aspects of what he's doing. For example, you know, I asked him yesterday about childhood memories of the Vuelta. He said, yeah, he watched the Vuelta, but couldn't name anything specific about Vueltas.
It's so dangerous, isn't it, for riders, though?
It is, because, but I wonder whether that's the issue with him.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it would be.
I don't sense that that's the issue with
But you
him.
Do sense sometimes when you speak to riders a hesitation when they talk about, you know, races that they watched growing up, and, you know, riders who are now discredited and they're reluctant to pin their colours to their mast, as it were, you know, which is understandable.
One past Vuelta that he will be very familiar with is 2016, because that was the first Vuelta he rode and he finished in the top 10. I think he finished 7th or 6th or 7th overall. And another thing I've noticed about, well, this year's race is that there are an awful lot of finishes, or several finishes that we've still got to come, that Yates did in 2016, and he knows pretty well. There's tomorrow, and then there's Lagos de Covadonga, there is La Camperona, and then on the final weekend, we have got two stages in Andorra, and of course, Simon Yates lives in Andorra, and we'll know those roads inside out. So that presumably will be a bit of an advantage.
It's an interesting, you talked about this on the podcast already, I think, the fact that he's got the memory of the Giro, the collapse at the Giro in the final couple of days, and the knowledge of exactly what these days will involve here at the Vuelta. But I'd like to pull you up on something you said on the podcast when I wasn't here. You, I think, and I quote or I paraphrase, that the Buffalo gave me pelters for saying during the Giro that I think, and this, my memory may be failing me here, because that's increasingly
that's
happened
the age you are now,
quite
yeah.
a lot.
Yeah.
But I think I agreed with you when you said that Simon Yates, at various points of the Giro, had only won one Tirreno Adriatico.
I thought ridiculous thing you'd ever heard.
Well, if I said that, then I very quickly came round to agreeing with you.
It was a great point.
We'll have to go back and re-listen, or somebody will. But I was pretty sure I agreed with that, because I was also sort of urging caution when it came to anointing Simon Yates. I certainly remember in, where was it? The place on the sort of the final weekend where Yates took some more time, won another stage. The
Zapata.
Zapata, exactly. I remember there talking about the just how far there still was to go, and that Yates was unproven over that final third week. And I think pretty much that's what I said.
Well, on that issue of him being unproven over the 3 weeks, I was having a conversation with a colleague the other day about Superman Lopez Superman, of course, being his official first name now, everyone has adopted that now. And who is more likely to win, Lopez or Yates? And I sort of played devil's advocate a little bit in saying that Superman Lopez has a complete, is a step further on in his career than Simon Yates, in that he has finished on a podium, and the podium of a Grand Tour at the Giro, the natural next step for him is to win one. The next step in Simon Yates's career, perhaps, is to finish on the podium, and then the following step is to win one. But it doesn't always work like that. And what carries more value in terms of credentials, in terms of pedigree, is it to lead, and not just lead, but really dominate a Giro d'Italia until 2 days from the end, or ride, sort of come up on the rails and not really be in contention at any point, and then sneak third place on the last mountain stage, which is what Lopez did at the Giro. And in fact, I think that point is doubly relevant because, by all accounts, Superman Lopez is someone who, oddly for a superhero,
doesn't like the pressure. Yeah, that's the impression that one gets. And you're absolutely right. He hasn't got that experience that Simon Yates has got at all.
He's got a very good team.
He does have a very strong team, doesn't he?
Yeah, I completely forgot that Peo Bilbao is also riding for Astana here. Jan Hirt.
Very strong team.
And Dario Cataldo. Omar Fraile.
Very strong team.
Probably the strongest team in the mountains.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want to tell tales when he's not here, but Fran said last night that he thought Fabio Aru could still win the Vuelta. There you go. There's one if you want to put some money on an outsider. Fran, that is, he's Fran's bet. Now, Daniel, I spoke to Jack Haig at the finish today. As I said, he's the only rider on the Michelin Scott team who rode both the Giro and the Vuelta, so he's in a good position to talk about the differences, the things in common between the two races and the team's approach. Here he was today at the finish. I was going to ask you, you were in the Giro team as well, obviously. I think you're the only guy, as well as Simon, who was in the Giro team as well.
Yep, I think you're right there.
Yeah, yeah. How does it compare? I mean, obviously there you were defending the jersey for a long time. I mean, what would you say you learned from that as a team? And how will that affect how you approach it here?
I think maybe you've seen the way we've raced this first sort of week and a bit, that we've been a little bit more conservative than we were at the Giro. I think at the Giro, we sort of came out all guns blazing and everyone had quite good form and we were using that. We were going out there, attacking stages, taking the jersey, riding on the front. I think now we've taken a bit more of a conservative approach and a bit more of like a holistic overall thinking about how we use the strategy for being here. But also, the first week here was much longer than at Giro, but the Giro is much harder, much, much harder. Like, and even talking to some of the other riders that did both, the first week of the Giro, like, we got to that first rest day, and after all the travel to and from Israel and everything, we were pretty tired. And at this rest day, talking with everyone in this team, everyone was not too bad.
So what's the feeling like? Because at the Giro, there seemed to be a sort of different atmosphere almost around the team that, you know, as you say, you went out all guns blazing. Yeah. Simon had the jersey, we're going to defend it. Here, Simon seemed almost not sorry, but not over the moon to have the jersey. He seems to be taking a far more cautious approach.
Yeah, well, we got the jersey a little bit too early in the Giro and we had it and it was great, but we didn't finish with it. And that's the ultimate goal. When we come to the Grand Tours now, the ultimate goal is to finish with the jersey. So it doesn't matter if we have it now, if we don't have it at the end. Mm. So sort of the goal and when we entered into this race was to be a bit more conservative. And we also don't have the same team that we had at the Giro. The team we had at the Giro, we could ride the front. We had a Sueno, we had a Bewley and people like this. And whereas here we have a bit more of sort of like a half climber, half sprinter setup.
Yeah, so it's all about the final week really, isn't it? And the final few days in particular.
Absolutely. Like a lot of us actually live or train in Andorra and we know that Andorra stage quite well and a lot can happen there. Like, and it's just stage 20. The race could turn on its head right there and then. So I think we're not looking too far ahead and making sure that we try and do all the little things right so those last couple of stages can really play a key role in the hopefully finishing with a jersey.
Don't forget to listen to our morning show, Kilometer Zero, supported by The Economist, Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings throughout the Vuelta a España.
Yes, a little reminder there that we are releasing episodes of Kilometer Zero at the Vuelta a España, three a week. That's Monday, Wednesday and Friday. So there were three last week. There was one on the rest day and that looked at the transfer market. The Kilometre Zero tomorrow looks at the Spanish institution that is Movistar, a team that has been around since 1980, when it started as Reynolds, and it's gone through various guises since then, and is obviously here challenging for the win at the Vuelta. And it looks at the team over the years. We've got an interview that you did, Fran, with Sebastian Unzué, whose father, Eusebio Unzué, is still the main man in charge. And he, amazingly, was also the man who set the team up back in 1980 with José Miguel Echavarri.
Exactly. And the history of the team actually dates back as much as to 1972, when it was first created, this junior cycling team that afterwards, with time, evolved into the Reynolds team. You know, it's a pretty long story, especially a pretty long story of survival with not that many sponsors, which is pretty amazing compared to the current cycling teams. You know, the common use of cycling teams, we change sponsors every 4 or 5 years. Movistar has only had 5 sponsors I can think of: Reynolds, Banesto, Illes Balears, Balearic Islands, Kestepan, and finally Movistar team. So 5 sponsors for 40 years of run. That's pretty impressive.
Next year will be their 40th year in the peloton. It's quite remarkable that it's the same guy in charge, and it's a real sort of dynasty. And a lot of riders stay with that team a long time. You know, the duration of their careers, guys like Miguel Indurain, Alejandro Valverde. Sebastian Unzué gives us his top 3 riders over the 4 decades. So it's quite a surprising choice in his top 3. But you'll hear that in tomorrow's episode of Kilometre Zero.
Yeah, about riders staying, can I make another point?
Of course.
Look at the DSs that they have. Most of them are former riders of the team. José Luis Arrieta, Chente García Costa, Pablo Lastras, even José Luis Laguía, who has already left, or José Luis Jaime Arena, who I think didn't make it to the pro ranks, but has been was also involved with the team as a rider before making it to become DS. You know, so it's pretty much a team that fits itself with talent and the new personnel.
I spoke to Nicolas Portal, the Team Sky director that finished today, about Movistar. This won't be in the episode, but you know, he rode for Caisse d'Epargne before he joined Team Sky, and he said, you know, because a lot of people hold these two teams up as being as being complete opposites in terms of their approach. And we had a great quote from Alex Dowsett a while ago saying that, you know, he rode for Team Sky, rode for Movistar. He said that if you had a 10 o'clock training ride for Team Sky, you had to turn up at 9:45. For Movistar, you could turn up about 10:25. It wouldn't matter. And that kind of symbolised the cultural difference between the teams. But Nicolas Portal was saying that, you know, for all their, I'd say, old school sort of approach and mentality, he said they are always the team that we fear the most. He said BMC, you know, Katusha, other teams have come along with big budgets and big riders. Movistar are always the number one threat in any Grand Tour, and they have won. And I, you know, they've won more Grand Tours than any other team in the post-war period. They won 14 Grand Tours in total.
Yeah, I mean, they have the Spanish pool of talent to pick from. Now they have they are the sole World Tour team in Spain, so they pretty much can choose between a very vast variety of riders which one they bring on board to the team. And that definitely helps. Sebastian told me about the eye that Eusebio has to find the proper riders, you know. And I can tell you, I work as press officer for the feeder team, and I can tell you that they really have a specific set of qualities they want to see in any rider they pick. So with that recruitment policy, it's not strange that they always can have a good roster to actually defy any other team that comes.
And I didn't realize that that Eusebio Unzué comes from quite a well-off family, and that the family's fortune was made in animal food for animals.
Exactly.
So that's Kilometre Zero coming tomorrow on Movistar. Now, a rider who featured in a Kilometre Zero that we produced 2 or 3 years ago during the Tour de France called Book Club, which focused on riders who were big readers, was Bauke Mollema. I'm not going to make the joke about his name sounding like book, but he is a big reader. He's read 3 books already at this Vuelta. And he was worried that he was running out, so he took a trip into Salamanca yesterday on the team's big electric bike to look for bookshops in which to buy new books. And I thought that was quite an interesting little story, an unusual way to spend your rest day. So I spoke to Malcolm Olama at the start this morning in Salamanca.
You like this bike?
Yeah, it's a really good one. Eh? It's fast.
Are you going to be able to get back on your other bike for the stage today?
Yeah, it'll be a little bit more difficult, eh? Because this one has an extra engine. that's a good one.
Tell me about your tour yesterday. You went and explored the city.
Yeah, we were just, I think, 5 kilometers from the city centre. And I didn't really want to ride my own bike, you know, the normal bike. I prefer to have a total rest day, especially because today is quite flat. Sometimes when it's a mountain day, yeah, then it's better to ride your bike. But when it's easy, I prefer to not ride at all. And we were close to the center. I knew the city already because I was here in 2010. I spent here like 10, 12 days with my wife, who was studying Spanish here at the moment. So then I was here for training camp, and it's a really nice city, really old city, and good atmosphere. So I just took this bike walked around my bike in the city for a few hours.
You were looking for bookshops, I understand.
Yeah, I needed some books because I almost finished. I still have two, but I think it's not enough to make Madrid. So I was just looking for a few more books, and I think there's a lot of culture, a lot of atmosphere in this city also. A lot of old buildings, so it was really nice to be back.
We did a podcast with you a couple of years ago about your reading on Gran Tours. What have you been reading here? What's has there been a highlight, this book that you've read this tour?
Well, I read that, already finished, I think, three books. The last one, the Millennium, from the Swedish writer. What else? Yeah, a Dutch book. You don't know it, about Hendrik Groen, quite popular book in Holland last year's. Well, this is the third book of this writer. What else I finished? A book about the US, the history of the US, from a Dutch writer. And another one. Yeah, I don't remember.
Found any good ones yesterday?
Not really, because some bookshops were closed. I looked up in the internet first, and then there was supposed to be a good one, but it was not even open anymore. And then another one was closed on Mondays. So, and then some didn't have really a lot of books in English. So in the end, I just found a thriller from what is his name? Peterson. That was more or less all I could find, so it was not really high class books, but anyway,
we'll put out an appeal for books for Malcolm Olama. On the race, Bagheera, obviously a big day a couple of days ago. I mean, a disappointment, I guess, in the end. You're using this Vuelta though to prepare for the World Championship specifically, aren't you?
That is also my big goal this last part of the season, and I like the Vuelta. You know, there's still 2 weeks to go, and I really want to go for a stage win, and I'm motivated and I feel good. So I think there will be more opportunities, and I was close already twice, and hopefully I can take a stage win the next 2 weeks, and then the Worlds. I think this racing the Vuelta like this is a really good preparation also for the Worlds, and so that will really really help me, I think, in Austria.
A very very strong Dutch team named for the World Championships. Any idea at this stage how that will play out on the road, or is it the kind of race where it's such a hard course that there'll be a natural selection anyway?
Yeah, for sure, it will be a super hard course, and in the end, I didn't see the parkour yet, but maybe it will come down to the last steep climb, because that one seems super super hard. But before, with the long climb that you have to do, I think 6-7 times, it will be super hard race anyway. And our selection is official already. We are only bringing a lot of good climbers, so maybe we don't have the biggest favorite like Alaphilippe or maybe Nibali, I don't know, or some other guys. But I think we have a lot of guys who can finish well, even on the podium with a good day, and so that we have to profit from that.
And next chance for stage win here, maybe Friday.
I don't know exactly now.
Steep stomach finish.
Maybe Saturday is better finish, and Sunday.
And yeah, I will just see, look at it day by day. At least today will be quite relaxed.
So that was Bauke Mollema preparing here, as he said, for the World Championships. And I mentioned the Dutch team. They've announced a really strong team for the World Championship road race in Innsbruck. Tom Dumoulin, Wilco Kelderman, Steven Kruiswijk, Bauke Mollema, Sam Omen, Wout Poels, Antoine Tolhoek and Peter Wiening. I mean, that's an astonishingly good team. Mollema suggested that, you know, the toughness of the course would decide who was the leader. But what on earth? I mean, how on earth do you pick someone from that lot to lead the team? I mean, there are three or four potential winners there.
Yeah, there is none of the top five favorites, I would say, for the Innsbruck Worlds. But there are a handful of guys who could well be in the 6th to 12th place in that power ranking, let's say, of main favorites. So I guess it will be about playing cards well, picking the breakaways, having one, two guys in every group that breaks away, and hoping for the best, because there is not a guy I would single out about as the best possible chance for victory for the Dutch team.
Nope. Well, the World Championships are a long way away. There's a lot of Vuelta to come before then. We'll head off to our hotel now, Fran. We're not too far tonight. It's about half an hour away.
Yeah, we are going to sleep today in Zamora, Jaime Rosón's hometown. Jaime Rosón, Movistar rider, currently with the bio passport being reviewed. I have to find out how that is going.
Yeah, that was
around.
A case from earlier this year, wasn't it?
Yeah, which exactly. In June, just before the Tour de France. Yeah.
Yeah, doping cases these days don't seem to be resolved very quickly. Samuel Sanchez, who was thrown out the Vuelta on the eve of last year's race, we're going to his hometown in a few days, and his case still unresolved as well. So.
Yeah. There is a difference between the two cases, because of course Samuel was a outright positive test, while with Jaime it's more a discussion about the values and everything, you know. So. But yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate that these cases of doping or suspected doping carry on for so long.
It is. And on that note, let's go and have some dinner, Fran. I'll see you tomorrow.
Okay, doping for our stomachs. Okay, see you tomorrow, Rich.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.